All right, it looks like everyone can hear us and see the screen, so we will get started. Once again, I want to thank you for joining us today for the webinar focusing on opportunities in law and political science with the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program. My name is Michelle Belorchi, and I'm an outreach and recruitment specialist at the Institute of International Education in Washington, D.C., and I'm happy to have a distinguished scholar join us today, David Wirth, who is a professor of law at Boston College. He was a Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Russia in 2016 and 2017. We'll be hearing more about his project and his experience in Russia in the next few minutes, and we'll be able to have questions and answers directly. You can answer, direct your questions to him. I'll start off today by going over some basics of the program and who this is intended for, as well as some of the opportunities in law and political science. So for those of you that are joining us today, this program is specifically for academics and professionals who are interested in teaching and researching around the world, and those that have had professional experience for several years. If you are a recent graduate, we do have several opportunities in the Fulbright Student Program. Even though it's called the Student Program, you are not required to be a student. So I would encourage you to check that website for more information. But today we're focusing on opportunities for U.S. citizens who are affiliated with U.S. institutions in the United States and or independent scholars. All right, so getting started, in terms of the baseline eligibility for the scholar program, as I mentioned, U.S. citizenship is required. And then after that, it really depends on the award description and what that particular country is looking for. So it may or may not require a PhD or a terminal degree. Oftentimes, there's also requirements for teaching experience or a certain number of years of professional experience. So that will be outlined in the award description. We also have policies, updated policies on previous scholars applying for additional Fulbright Scholar grants. There is a two-year waiting period from the time your grant ends to the time you apply for another grant. Okay, so just diving right in, I'm going to focus region by region. So we have six world regions. We offer almost 100 awards in law and political science, and that means those awards specifically list law or political science as a preferred discipline. And then, of course, we have more than half of the 450 unique award offerings are open to all disciplines. So the awards that I have outlined here today for you are not the only awards available. They're just highlights in the region that I'd like to point out. So starting with the East Asia and Pacific region, we have two awards to Australia. One is the Distinguished Chair Award in Public Policy, located at Flinders University and Carnegie Mellon University. Now, for those of you that are new to the program, the Distinguished Chair Awards are the most prestigious award category in the program, and those are particularly, they particularly seek distinguished scholars who have a strong record in publication, research, and teaching. Typically, if you're at an institution, you would need to be at the associate professor or full professor level. The other award to Australia is brand new this year, and it is called the Australia-United States Alliance Studies. And this is a placed award as well. It's brand new. The commission in Australia is very happy to be offering this. We have a very strong Fulbright Commission in Australia that is looking to bring in scholars who are experts on Australia-United States relations. Moving on, we have a teaching grant to Japan. Now, whereas the two awards in Australia were focused on research, this award specifically is looking for academics and professionals to teach about issues related to the United States. So even though it's called Study of the United States, that pertains to the students who are taking the course. So this is open not only to political science experts, but also American studies and historians, etc. In Korea, we have a unique opportunity for teaching also in peace studies. And this is an award that is placed, the scholar would be placed at the Graduate Institute of Peace Studies at Kyunghee University. It's one of the most prestigious institutes in the country, known for the scholarship and research and faculty there. So this is a unique opportunity to be on the Korean Peninsula studying, researching, as well as teaching students at the Graduate Institute. We do have an award to Philippines. It's open to all disciplines, but it specifically states an interest in democratic governance, environmental sustainability, human rights, international law, international relations, and transnational issues, as well as peace and conflict studies. So for those of you that have a background in those specializations, you would have a competitive advantage over others, for example, that are applying in disciplines that where their preferences, the specialization is not listed. So keep in mind, if you're looking at awards that are open to all disciplines, they are truly open to all disciplines, but the specializations listed there are somewhat of a wish list, you can say, that country has outlined that they would like to bring scholars in those fields. And then the other exciting opportunity that I wanted to share, and again, this is by no means exhaustive for this region, is the multi-country opportunity that we have in Southeast Asia. That is the ASEAN Research Program. And that allows scholars to conduct research in 2 to 3 member countries of the ASEAN, the Association for Southeast Asian Nations, conducting research related to the 3 pillars of their goals as a alliance. So that is something for those of you that have projects that relate to more than one country in that region, this would be a wonderful opportunity to undertake research there. Okay, moving on to the Western Hemisphere. We have several awards, Distinguished Chair Awards to Brazil. And these are partnered with particular universities and foundations. So depending on your background, you could orient yourself to that particular award. So for example, at the University of Sao Paulo, they are looking for a Distinguished Chair in International Relations. We then have an interesting partnership with the Joaquim Nabuco Foundation, specifically looking for public policy experts. And then the Federal University of Minas Gerais is looking for scholars who can teach and research on U.S. Law and politics and things of that nature. So those are the 3 opportunities specific to Brazil. We also have the All Disciplines Award to Brazil with up to 30 grants, so 30 spots available for that as well, if your particular field does not fit into the 3 that are listed here, and or if you're not at the career level to be considered a distinguished chair. So it's important to keep in mind as you search the catalog for opportunities to not only match up according to your field of expertise, but also your career level. You will notice some are open to academics that are in their early career academics, in other words, terminal degree within the last 5 years, others that are open to postdocs, as well as others that are specifically for senior scholars. Moving on, we have the research chairs in policy, law, and governance in Canada. And keep in mind, the research chairs differ from the distinguished chair. So the research chairs are open to all levels of academics. The interesting thing with Canada is that their awards are they're not necessarily placed exactly. It's open depending on your field of expertise. So when you click on the award to view it, it'll recommend placements depending on if you're a law expert, maybe it'll be at University of Alberta or in Calgary or in Ontario, depending on where your expertise falls. A letter of invitation also is not required for Canada. In Mexico, there's the U.S. Studies Professorship or Chair. Again, this is also open to kind of mid-career academics. It's not necessarily just the Distinguished Chair, so there is that the difference there, and it's focused on teaching. So the interesting thing about this award is that there are four potential universities where the scholar could be placed depending on their field of expertise, whether it's U.S. politics and governance or U.S.-Mexico relations, et cetera. And then last but not least, again, just another highlight, by no means an extensive list of all the opportunities in the Western Hemisphere, we have the multi-country opportunity to Canada and Mexico. And this is a wonderful opportunity for researchers to be able to spend equal amounts of time in both Canada and Mexico for a project that relates to North America in general, looping in all of these countries. All right, and then moving on to our largest region in terms of awards available, we are, and again, I tried to get them all in one slide, the awards to Europe. And really, I just want to point out that a lot of these are opportunities to be placed specifically in an institution or a university. So you'll notice, for example, in Austria, it's at the Diplomatic Academy, right? With Belgium, the opportunity is that you'll be able to work alongside colleagues who are working at NATO and being, you know, invited to the conference and working with the Fulbright Commission there, doing site visits and things like that. The awards that are labeled as EU, we have three awards, actually. Two of them are at the European University Institute in Florence, and they alternate every other year with a placement in Belgium. So it depends. So this year, for example, it is Italy. The EU Affairs Award is a multi-country option that allows you to conduct research in 2 to 3 EU countries. So that's what the Schumann Awards are. And then you'll notice we have several awards to Iceland that are very unique opportunities. And in this case, the one that I have highlighted is the Fulbright Ministry of Foreign Affairs Arctic Scholars. So again, looking at issues, legal issues in the Arctic, political science issues, kind of relations among the Arctic countries, and the scholar works directly with colleagues at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Iceland. So again, this is just a smattering of some of the many awards available in Europe and Eurasia. North Macedonia has one specifically looking at rule of law, judiciary reform, and civil society. Norway has phenomenal opportunities at the Nobel Institute, as well as the International Courts and Tribunals Award. Poland has a Distinguished Chair Award in Eastern European and Eurasian Studies in Warsaw. And again, Portugal has a specific award to law, and there's a Distinguished Chair at Lund University in Sweden. So these are all wonderful experiences, and you can find out more information in the award description. And if you have any questions, again, all of the awards have our names and email and phone numbers of the specialists who look after these awards and can advise you accordingly. All right, moving right along, we are looking at Middle East and North Africa. We've got the All Disciplines Award to Jordan, Kuwait, and Oman, and those are open to locations of the applicant's choice. So you'll also notice that we have several awards that are not placed. It's up to the applicant to determine where they would be the best fit, which university or which research center, which think tank, et cetera. If you are unfamiliar with the available potential host affiliations, hosts in that country, we are happy to assist in that. If you've never been to any of these countries that are listed, for example, we are happy to help. We can contact our colleagues overseas and get some potential suggestions for you to reach out. You're also welcome to contact our alumni that are listed in the Fulbright Scholar Directory. The award to Egypt, for example, is based at the American University of Cairo. And then, of course, you can go and look on the website and see which professors to reach out to or which colleagues to reach out to for the letter of invitation. We always advise that you seek out the invitation from the person that you will be closely collaborating with or the person who's designated to provide that invitation. And keep in mind that invitation is non-binding. In terms of the opportunities in Israel, there are 9 unique awards open to all levels of scholars. And this is actually very, Israel has a huge offering open to all disciplines. And so I wanted to just highlight the number of awards. And they're open to not only senior scholars, but they also have several postdoc awards. There's a postdoc at Haifa University. Ben-Gurion University has some opportunities. So a lot of those are placed awards, but certainly they are open to all disciplines, which is wonderful. And then last but not least, we have the multiple kind of multi-country opportunities, which are unique. And this is something that Fulbright's really happy to be able to offer. These are relatively new opportunities as we continue to innovate in the program. We have the Morocco-Spain Joint Teaching and Research Award. This has been around for a couple of years, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to conduct research and to teach in both countries and really kind of continue with your top your research project that involves both countries, whether it's Morocco-Spain relations or, you know, kind of EU and all of this kind of thing. So that is one opportunity that's available, as well as the Middle East and North Africa Regional Research Program, which allows you to conduct research in more than one country in the MENA region. Okay, moving on to South and Central Asia. This is the region that I also look after, so I cover the Western Hemisphere and South and Central Asia. So if you have any questions relating to these particular regions, I'm happy to help you. We have several awards that are open to multiple disciplines. So you'll notice we've mentioned all disciplines awards, but we have some that are open to multiple disciplines where it's a little more restrictive. They have a set list of disciplines that they're interested in. So for example, Bhutan is looking to bring in one American scholar every year who would be able to teach for 10 months. So again, in this particular region, as well as the Sub-Saharan Africa region, you'll notice the grants tend to be longer in nature because they're looking at capacity building. So there will be teaching or a focus on teaching and research. So Bhutan is available, as well as Kazakhstan, interested in law and political science. The Maldives specifically is interested in bringing law scholars to work in their ministries there. So that's an exciting opportunity to go to the Maldives, a very beautiful country at the southern tip of India. Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, Central Asian countries that have a few awards available to bring in American scholars. The teaching can be done in English. Research, you can hire a translator if need be. So the language should not be a barrier, and there aren't any language requirements per se for these countries. So that's another question that comes up often is, all of the teaching will be done in English unless it's otherwise stated. So I believe there's only a handful of countries, I can think of Francophone Africa, as well as some of the countries in Western Hemisphere that require some level of local language fluency. Places like India and Nepal, English is used widely, so you can certainly carry out teaching or research projects over there. India is the largest program we have in the U.S. Scholar Program. They offer 42 grants under the Academic and Professional Excellence Award, as well as 2 extra grants for the Distinguished Chair Award. So a total of 44 scholars go to India every year. So that's another great opportunity. Nepal specifically has an affiliation with the Kathmandu School of Law. So all of you that have a law background and are interested in teaching and research, Nepal would be a great option as well. And then, of course, the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program is available for researchers to conduct a project in 2 to 3 countries in the region. All right, so the last region before we open up to our alum and have some questions. I know I'm going through this pretty quickly, but for the sake of time, we need to stay on track. So the last region that I want to focus on are the awards to Sub-Saharan Africa, starting out with a specific award in Burkina Faso looking for scholars in law. And then after that, we do have several countries in the region that are seeking researchers and faculty to teach in Cameroon, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, at the University of Zambia, as well as in Zimbabwe. So, for example, the Zambia Award is a partner award with the University of Zambia, so that one is placed. The other ones are open to appropriate institutions, and or they do list the universities where they would like scholars to be placed. So if a letter of invitation is required, the embassy contact is typically listed there, or you can reach out to us and we can assist in that. Again, as you'll notice, all countries have a regional opportunity, and that is the case for Africa through the Africa Regional Research Program. This is the only award that allows you to conduct research, research only in one or more countries. So that would be your option for that region. So at this point, I want to see, let's see if we have any questions before we move on to introducing our alum and having David Worth speak. So let's see, do we have any questions coming in, Ginny? Okay, let's bring in David. So David, thank you for joining us today. I'm so happy to have you on the line. David was our Fulbright Scholar Distinguished Chair in Russia in 2016-2017, based at the State University Higher School of Economics in Moscow. So David, can you tell us a little bit about what you did, where was it, and how it all went?
Certainly, and thank you, Michelle. It's a real privilege to be here today. Can people hear me?
Yes, coming in clear.
Yes. Okay, very good. There were a few technical glitches on my end beforehand. They're digging up the street out in front of my house, and my Wi-Fi disappeared. It seems to be working fine now. First of all, I will try to put my experience in the very carefully constructed framework that Michelle just set out. My experience fit into many of the categories that she was describing. In fact, I'm a little bit jealous because now I hear about so many others that might have been. Just one word about the picture, because I have a certain fondness for this, this particular view. You're looking across the Moscow River to the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. The cathedral was built in the late 1800s, and then it was demolished by Stalin to make room for what was supposed to be the tallest building in the world called the Palace of the Trade Unions. There are, in fact, pictures of it being blown up and the top taken off. The palace was supposed to be topped by an enormous statue of Lenin. It was supposed to be taller than the Empire State Building. During the Second World War, it had to be taken apart for scrap metal to support the war effort, and it was basically a relic site after that. The Soviet government decided to build the world's largest swimming pool on the site, which existed there until after the end of the Soviet Union. And by public subscription, this church was reconstructed almost identically to the original 19th century version by public subscription, so by the generosity of the Russian people. In fact, I lived sufficiently close that I could see it out my window. So enough for local color. As Michelle said, I was very fortunate to have been the holder of the first Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Sustainable Development at the Higher School of Economics in academic year 16-17. In fact, this is my second Fulbright, it was in fact spaced not by 2 years, but by 20 years. the Higher School of Economics was founded in 1992 by Yegor Gadar, who was Yeltsin's principal economic advisor, a rather controversial figure who oversaw privatization in the former Soviet Union. It is now one of the principal universities in the Russian Federation, and it is particularly well known for being an open environment, to being a scholarly environment where sometimes controversial ideas can be kicked around in an open setting without concern for whether they comport with official wisdom or not. The name is actually something of a misnomer. I went to a meeting of the Foreign Advisory Board where it was announced that the Higher School of Economics had acquired a physics faculty, and the chair of the meeting, the rector, quipped, "Well, Now we should call ourselves the Higher School of Everything, and we wouldn't even have to change the acronym in English, HSE. So it is a world-class major university, not just in economics, but in many other disciplines, including law, which is my area of specialization. Unlike Moscow State University, which has an iconic building, the campus is distributed throughout Moscow and is integrated into the city. The award, as Michelle mentioned, is based on sustainability. I heard her mention at least one other award focusing on sustainability, the notion that we are attempting to preserve the options of future generations while meeting the needs of the present. So, for instance, in the current pandemic, one might look at the question of wildlife sales for food as sustainable or not, or under what conditions might they be sustainable. Right before this webinar, I was watching Andrew Cuomo on the television, who was talking about gradually opening up New York State in a language that is very close to sustainability. What is essential, what is not, what sorts of risks are we prepared to accept, which are we not. So this is a very important framing device coming from the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, which has become the principal catchphrase, if you will, for environment and a variety of other disciplines. Almost any discipline, by the way, will fit under the under the rubric of sustainability. I work on climate in there. It has attracted a lot of attention of engineers who are in the business of building things. So they're talking about putting mirrors in space to reflect the sun's rays. So sustainability is a, at least to my way of thinking, a very broad umbrella that could include many sorts of projects and many different disciplines. Just to give you a sense of what I actually did when I was there, this is a teaching and research grant. So to my way of thinking, one gets the best of both worlds. The application asked me to identify the distribution between teaching and research, and I think I said 65% teaching, 35% research. That's in fact about how it worked out. I was put to work as a regular line faculty member in the Faculty of Law and in their English language, master's program in international economic law. International economic law being trade law, the law of foreign investment, and my research specialty, one of them, is the relationship between those fields and sustainability. So it was quite a good match. They actually made my course a required, I taught two courses, they were both required courses in their new master's program, so I certainly felt honored to be at the center of their curriculum. My students were all master's students of varying ages, maybe something like 22 up to about 30, because in Russia, as in most other countries, other than the United States, law is an undergraduate discipline. I can talk more about the students during the question and answer period, but they were an extraordinarily rewarding group to work with, and the English was exceptional. I also supervised four master's research papers, four theses, and I served as a faculty coach for a moot court team that went to Frankfurt on issues of foreign investment. Those of you who are law faculty will understand the term. This is a mock argument before an investment tribunal. On the research side, I made an effort early on to contact the journals that are located at the Higher School of Economics in both the law faculty and otherwise. I wrote a piece on SPEC, so to speak, for the International Organization's Research Journal. It was published in both English and Russian. This is on the Paris Agreement, which was new at the time, and how it fits into the larger climate framework. I also did some other research on the Paris Agreement and publications while I was there. Hopefully delivering on the research component. This was important to me. I undertook a series of speaking engagements, mostly on climate. I spoke at the embassy at the at the American Center located at the embassy 2 days before the Paris Agreement entered into force. Many Russians came and participated in an excellent discussion. I also spoke at my alma mater, St. Petersburg State University, where my presentation was a little bit more controversial. Climate change is a major political issue, and I had an opportunity to speak at the St. Petersburg Spring Forum. Just to wrap up, I also used the opportunity to take 10 hours a week of Russian lessons, which probably was a bigger commitment of my time than almost anything else when I was there. But it was quite valuable to me because I wanted to see how my students were being taught. Since then, I've maintained a professional collaboration with the law faculty and the academic dean, the principal deputy dean. I also teach at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and the Fletcher School and I are talking about a cooperative program where my course on international environmental law might be taught remotely as soon as this fall. The Fulbright office continues to have projects both for those who are in the country at the time and also alumni such as myself. Until the pandemic hit, there was some talk about a conference to be held near Lake Baikal on the environment in one of the most environmentally sensitive areas of Russia. So I would say that just in closing that this Fulbright has added significantly to the depth of my understanding, certainly about Russia. I'm enormously grateful for the professional opportunity. It also, for those of you who might be considering this particular award, this is an area that is not overpopulated, shall we say. If you go and have a similar experience, then you will be one of the experts that is in demand when you come back. So hopefully that gives you a sense of one particular award, not necessarily confined to the Russia experience, but also specifically at the Higher School of Economics. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Excellent, David. So if you could just clarify, for this particular award to Russia, was the Higher School of Economics the designated location, or how did you come about that?
Yes, this is a specific award for the Higher School of Economics and on sustainability. As I recall, there was a list of disciplines that included law, which obviously attracted my attention, but others as well, I think economics and others. So it is specifically at the Higher School of Economics, which I personally happen to think is a good thing. It's as opposed to other institutions in Moscow. It's a very welcoming and open and engaging place. And the subject matter was also specified, although the discipline was not.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you come to consider Russia in the first place? You did mention being there earlier on in your academic career, but does your work specifically continue to work with Russia, or how did you arrive on that one point? Because many times we get questions from applicants, you know, there's so many awards to choose from and I can only select one. So.
Right. Well, first of all, at least so far as I'm concerned, Fulbright may say something else, but at least so far as I'm concerned, one could take maximum advantage of the opportunities presented by this award with no prior contact with Russia. Now, that having been said, I do have a particular affinity for the place. I actually started to study the Russian language when I was in college and fell in love with it. I ended up studying in what was then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, during the Soviet period. My interest, frankly, had been dormant for some time. Even during the Perestroika period at the beginning of the 1990s, many legal academics and legal scholars were involved in advising the former Soviet Union and also other Eastern European states about the structure of their legal system. I was busy with other things at the time. And so this is something that had that had somewhat gone dormant, and when I was casting around, this one jumped out at me. So the prior language experience was helpful, but again, at least so far as I'm concerned, not necessary. Russian is as a language, it has a lengthy history of instructing foreigners how to speak this. You go there, they will give you the entire program. It's worth it to have some connection with the language that is going on around you. But I think that's something that anybody could view as a work in progress as opposed to something that is essential. All of my students have better English than I have Russian.
I see. Okay, excellent. Yeah, so that brings me to the next question. What would you say to our audience would be the benefits of doing a teaching or research project through Fulbright?
Well, the on-site, hands-on immersion experience, to my way of thinking, there's no substitute for that. I mean, one can read about the environment in Russia or sustainability in Russia, legislation in a book, but there's no comparison with actually being there, talking to policymakers, talking to other academics. The texture, at least to my way of thinking, is everything. So that actually being a participant in the development of in the academic life of a foreign country, I think, is very different from watching it from the outside. I just think that there's no comparison. It also creates professional connections that certainly, in my case, have proven to be, excuse the expression, sustainable, in the sense that the deputy dean at the law faculty and I continue to be in contact about joint projects. So. Mm-hmm. And I was welcomed as a full member of the faculty, and let me tell you, I was put to work quite quickly. I don't think there's any better way to experience a place than to actually get out there and do it, as opposed to read about it.
Right. And could you speak a little to how the Fulbright Commission in Moscow engaged with you? We often, it's all over our catalog that, in addition to teaching and research duties or the research project, we encourage all Fulbrighters to hold lectures and workshops outside of their home at their host mm-hmm. institution. So was the commission
right.
helpful in connecting you, or how did that work?
Yes, very much so. My understanding is that the Fulbright Commission in Moscow basically was the moving force behind this grant. That's anecdotal evidence, and if I've got it wrong, I apologize. But I think the head of the Fulbright office there seemed to have, at least so far as I could see, identified sustainability as something that's important to Russia's future, which it is to the future of any country. So the Fulbright office seems to have been ahead of the curve in terms of, first of all, identifying the subject matter. Second of all, Russia is my first Fulbright was in organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is headquartered in Vienna and Poland. That was actually during the Perestroika period, but working in Russia is different from other places. You have to have an invitation every time you go to speak. I still have my binder with all of them, every single one of which has a stamp and a signature and a letterhead on it. It's a different culture. It's a very rewarding one. But the Fulbright office was extraordinarily helpful in navigating some of the challenges, many of the challenges of living and working there. That's the benefit. On the other hand, you have to fit into the expectations of the country. I should have counted before I got on this webinar, but I must have done a dozen speaking engagements. Some of which were facilitated by the Fulbright office, some of which I came up with on my own. The Higher School of Economics wanted me to do them. I was made available as a speaker by the Fulbright Office to a science festival at Moscow State University, another institution in Moscow. So it's a mix of my supervisors at the Higher School of Economics identifying opportunities and the Fulbright Office. I would say it's symbiotic. One other point is that I must have done 5 or 6 review meetings looking at applications from Russian scholars who wanted to study in the United States. That was a very rewarding way for me to give back, and also to see what the academic landscape in Russia looked like. So, for instance, we had one applicant who was coming from Irkutsk, which is right near Lake Baikal. She did studies of fish, and she needed to bring refrigerated boxes of her fish samples to the United States. But one of the big questions was, can you bring that sort of thing into the U.S. or not? What's the point of giving the person the grant if they can't do the kind of research that they want? So I saw a wide variety of perspectives, even sitting in Moscow looking at those applications, because there is a preference for applications from the regions.
All right, so great, David. Just one last question to you before we open it up to questions from the audience. What kind of advice would you give applicants regarding the application process and specifically the project statement?
Right, and this is not necessarily connected with this particular award, but in general, ISM is the question. I would first of all encourage an applicant to plan ahead, something I didn't do, but I give myself very good advice, very seldom follow it, but do plan ahead so that you can cast the net as widely as possible. The other award that I was potentially considering was one for China at where I would have been interested in being located at a new food safety institute at Renmin University. That was different from this because it was not an institution-specific grant. So do think about, is this a funnel in terms of the application? Are you in a pool of people looking at different institutions, or is it one institution specifically, as in my case? One is not better than the other. It's just one needs to be aware of what the shape of the expectations is. Second of all, I would set aside several days to write your project statement and focus it as tightly as possible, and give yourself time to revise it. That having been said, once you get on site, to some extent, all bets are off. When I ended up on site, the course that I was proposing to teach was not exactly what my supervisors wanted, and so I had to retool it on site and make it fit into their expectations. But my suggestion would be to have a clear sense of what you want to do and have the courage to set it out as crisply and cleanly as possible. Also, it helps to have a letter of invitation, because then, to some extent, you're pre-negotiating your Fulbright experience before you actually get on site. And you have some sense that the institution is interested in what you want to do, and not just you're putting in an application into a black hole.
All right, that's a good point. I would say about half of the awards in the catalog do require an invitation letter. The other half, I would say, either state it as preferred or optional. So certainly, even if it's not a requirement, it certainly helps you. And exactly as David says, it's kind of a pre-negotiation that at least you've gotten that sorted out. So if you are selected, then you can kind of hit the ground running. So David, thank you so much for sharing some insights. I want to open the questions now to the audience and see what they have to say. So let's see. So my colleague Chinny, I believe, has the questions open. So can we What are the questions that are coming in, Chinny?
Hi, everyone. So where do we get started? All right, Professor Wirth, could you talk about, could you discuss whether you had your family with you, and if you did, you know, what was that like?
Yes, I did have my family, which consists of I was traveling with my wife. My children are grown and off on their own. Wife is of Russian origin, which is one of the reasons that we were interested in being in Russia, but I don't think that it matters to my experience very much. In fact, sometimes being married to a native speaker can impede one's language learning. The Fulbright Office performed a very useful function in bringing all the Fulbrighters, including the language instructors, research grantees, everybody in the country together several times. So I got a sense of what other people were doing. Certainly other people had children with them. Whether they were going to school or not, I wasn't entirely clear. That's something you would definitely want to check out in advance. And presumably, Michelle, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the Fulbright Office at least might be able to provide some information about schooling opportunities, particularly if you're away for an entire academic year, as I was. But certainly there were other people in Russia that had children, including small children, with them.
Yes, and that's a good point, David. There are many awards that clearly state whether a dependent stipend is available. And to be qualified as a dependent, your family member would need to be with you for 80% of the grant duration. So, yes. Chinny, what's the next question we have?
All right. The next question that we have is, what made you want to do a teaching research Fulbright rather than just research?
Well, I don't know whether this is the correct way of thinking about it, but sustainability in higher school of economics looked attractive, and it was a teaching research Fulbright, and I figured I enjoy both, and I can certainly work with that. As I recall, the application identified the percentage that asked me to identify which percentage I wanted to spend my time on teaching or research. I have to say, I am very glad that I did the teaching that I did, because that was the really rewarding interpersonal aspect. Engaging with my students who were fantastic. I'm still in touch with them, some of them. One of them is, I'm now supervising, and she went on from my master's program and is now doing a PhD at the Higher School of Economics. So in terms of the professional and cultural benefits, I thought that more came from that than from research. Now, that having been said, I saw other people who were researching manuscripts at the Lenin Library, and this was their big opportunity to do that kind of thing. In fact, there was a woman who was there by herself with a younger child, maybe 8 or 9, who was doing that. It all depends on what your project is. I think that one needs to have a sense of mission about the project first. It's not for me to say whether research or teaching is better. I was glad that I had a mix of both. One thing that I did find about Russia, I was there 16 to 17. Very soon after I got there, it came out in the U.S. news, in U.S. media, that the Russian government was interfering in the U.S. election, which, of course, is something that attracted everybody's attention. And then there was the election and the inauguration and some chilly feelings, or at least somewhat on the political level. I have to say it did not affect me one iota. But on the political level. So I actually had some difficulty getting through to senior policymakers in the way that I might have wanted to. So in that case, I was glad that I hadn't put all my chips on that, as opposed to having the opportunity with the Higher School of Economics, which is in many ways, no, in terms of its philosophy and mission, no different from other universities.
All right, David.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Finney?
I'm turning it over to you now, Michelle.
Okay, so any other questions that we can answer right now, or can we proceed for the last final slide?
For David, that's all of the questions that we have for now.
Okay, excellent. We're wrapping it up. We've just got a few minutes left, but I wanted to share with you, we've gone through so many awards, we've discussed different things in terms of invitation letters and stipends and dependent benefits and all of these kinds of things. So I wanted just to outline for you, as you navigate the catalog of awards, again, there are over 450 unique awards in 135 countries, so be sure to check the individual tabs in the award description to see if there's an invitation requirement, what kind of language requirement, if any, what stipend, different, you know, depending on the award, assistant professors get a different stipend than full professors, for example. Researchers might have a different stipend than teaching faculty, et cetera. So it's important to take a look at that. The sooner you can start, you know, developing contacts abroad, or if you'd like us to assist you in doing that, that's absolutely fine. Oftentimes in the second tab, the award requirements tab, you will find a list of embassy contacts or the Fulbright Commission contacts. So you've heard David and I discuss the commission. Russia has a very, you know, robust team working in Moscow, so they have a dedicated staff working on the Fulbright program. We have 50 commissions globally, and then the rest of the countries are administered through the U.S. Embassy. So depending on where you get placed, you'll either have commission staff as your points of contact, or public affairs or the cultural affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy. So that's one way of looking at the awards, and I just wanted to share this slide. We've talked about the project statement. We had a question about, you know, why didn't you just do research, or should I do teaching and research? We get those questions a lot. It really depends, as David said, on what you hope to do in that country, but also you need to be cognizant of what the particular award is looking for. Some awards are really looking to bring Americans over to build capacity, curriculum development, teaching students in the classroom, so they might only have teaching as an option. Other awards, for example, in Australia, it's only research they're interested in. They're looking to bring in researchers. So you need to take a look at what the award is looking for. If it's open to all teaching or research or a professional project, that's up to you. If the ratio is open, that's up to you whether you want to do a 50-50 teaching research or kind of lean heavier on one side. So make sure that you discuss all of that, as well as the impact and kind of the anticipated multiplier effect, the outcomes, not only for your host institution, but also when you get back to the U.S., and also addressing why you're interested in Fulbright, those kind of things. Do we have any other questions, Chinny? I wanted to leave the last couple minutes. I know we're down to the wire, but if there's any other generic questions that I can answer, just let me know.
We do have mm-hmm. a few questions, actually. One moment. All right. Let's scroll to the top. All right. So, can you apply to multiple positions if you are more flexible on location?
Oh, excellent. I'm glad we have this question, because I did forgot to mention maybe you can only apply for one award per competition. So as I mentioned, I think half of the battle is really determining which award out of the 450 is the best match for you. So I think it's clear, for example, in David's case with his field of expertise in law, as well as sustainability and kind of environmental law, those kind of things, the Distinguished Chair Award in Russia was an excellent fit. That's the kind of fit you're looking for when you, you know, kind of scan through the awards catalog. You can set up an advising call with me or one of my team members, and we're happy to advise you accordingly. So certainly it's important to go through the catalog, narrow your options down, maybe email us or call us, and we can help you further narrow your options to the single award that you would be applying for.
Okay. Our next question is, do we need to have a PhD or is a JD enough?
Right, that's a great question. So we often mention, you know, PhD requirement and all of that in our awards, but actually it's PhD or terminal degree. So some awards do require a terminal degree, others don't. For the case of law, a JD is considered a terminal degree, so that would be fine.
Our next question is, what awards should professionals or early career academics look into?
So we do have a new feature. I'm glad we have this question. The new feature in our awards catalog is the professional project. So again, the scholar program over the past 2 years has really made an attempt to reach out to experts that are outside of academia, so lawyers, journalists, artists, et cetera. And so if you go in the awards catalog and filter according to early career or professionals, or even grant activity being a professional project, you will get the awards that would be geared towards you in law or political science, depending on what you're looking for.
All right. Our next question is, in case one doesn't get selected, are there any restrictions to apply during the next application cycle?
Oh, not at all. You're welcome to apply as many times, but again, one application per awards competition. So,
all right. So
excellent. Cindy, I think that should be our last question so that we can finish on time. I want to just share the last slide with everybody. If you have any questions that come up afterwards or if we didn't get to your question during the hour, please email us at scholars@iie.org. You're also welcome to reach out directly to the Fulbright specialist who's listed in the award description. Again, I have the South and Central Asia region as well as the Western Hemisphere. You can register with my Fulbright to get our webinar updates and program updates. Just go to cies2.org. And, of course, reach out with any questions or follow us on social media, and feel free to refer your colleagues. Thank you again so much, David, for joining us this afternoon. I really appreciate your time, and I want to thank all of our applicants, prospective applicants, and everyone in the audience who joined us. This webinar has been recorded and will be available on our website within a week. Thank you.